Will Rogers, Ambassador of Goodwill, Prince of Wit and Wisdom, Chapter 10. Rogers, the Philanthropist. Will Rogers was a philanthropist whom any man might well emulate. From the day that he used his last cent to pay the homeward passage for his homesick companion from the Argentine and face the world with empty pockets, Will always had a ready hand for the needy. In the days when he was an impecunious rider and roper in Wild West shows, he was known for his eagerness to share what he had with some less fortunate. As he climbed along the path to glory, his generosity kept pace with his mounting earnings. He gave without any ostentation, invariably masking his good deed in anonymity. No one, not even Rogers himself, could estimate the money he gave away. It was easily a good-sized fortune, even viewed by the standards of wealthy men of his time. He gave without question, and once when friends warned him that a certain man to whom he had given money was a fraud, Will only grinned and replied, "The poor devil probably needs it worse than I do." Everything he touched turned into money, but he worked for it and earned every penny of the huge amounts that came streaming in from the moving pictures, his writings, and broadcasts over the radio. In return for his good fortune, he made the burden lighter for thousands, not only in the United States, but far away beyond its confines. The greatest word in the life of Will Rogers was charity. He had a myriad of definitions for it and used every one of them. His public charities were legion, but his private charities would make even a longer roll. Money doesn't worry me. Money, to Will Rogers, meant only the means of doing greater good for his fellow man. He never sought it for himself. After he had provided security for his beloved family, he once remarked, while in a serious mood, "Money doesn't worry me anymore. All I care about is a good blue suit." He paused for a second and went on, "It doesn't even have to be good." Many old actors and vaudeville players, friends of his leaner days, found him a sure haven of refuge when hard times overtook them, and there were no bookings to bring them in a livelihood. Walter Kelly, famous Virginia judge of the stage, screen, and radio, told of an actor he had known who was spending his declining days in California. A group of New York actors had dug down into their grouch bags and raised enough money to send the old man to the coast in the hope that he might eke out a living playing small parts in the movies. He failed to connect. "I met him in a bank one day," Kelly said, "and asked him whether he was putting in money or taking it out. He showed me a check of $25 signed by Will Rogers. 'I'm putting it in,' the old fellow replied. 'I get one every week. It's what keeps me off the relief rolls. A lot of others get one like it each week, here and in New York. Will Rogers is taking care of us.'" There must have been an army of persons that Will took care of, as the incident related by Bernard Granville, popular musical comedy star who was associated with Rogers and vaudeville, will show. It took place in St. Louis. "One morning he left the hotel early," Granville related. "I followed, thinking we might have some fun together. He headed rapidly down the street and into a poor neighborhood. When I caught up with him, he was pressing money into the hand of a poor, aged woman who had been dispossessed and was sitting forlornly amidst her belongings in the street. How he heard of her case, I do not know. When Rogers saw me, he was acutely embarrassed. 'Bernard,' he pleaded, 'don't tell this around. They will just think it a publicity stunt,' and it wasn't. Granville kept it a secret for 25 years, only telling it after Rogers died. Whatever theater Rogers happened to be playing in turned out to be the mecca of stage folk that had known better times. It made no difference whether he ever played with them or not. An old Shakespeare actor, who might have been mistaken for the melancholy Dane in person, gained admittance to Rogers' dressing room one day. The actor showed Rogers a lot of old programs, relics of the days when he had appeared with great stars. 'And here I am, one of the old stars, broke,' declared the tragedian." Will laughed at the old as the old actor awaited the effect of his plea. "Well, old timer," said Rogers, "it looks like you saved programs instead of money." With the comment, however, Rogers' hand went down into his pocket and he gave the old player enough to carry him over for a month at least. A friend of cowboys. Cowboys, or men who said that they once were cowboys and had ridden with Rogers in Wild West shows, were always asking aid from Rogers. Many of them were probably nothing better than panhandlers and had no claim on him, but he never questioned their pleas. While making the motion picture Steamboat Round the Bend, however, he heard of an old cowboy with whom he actually worked in a Wild West show. The former friend would not go to Rogers, however, because he felt that the Oklahoman was too big a man to be bothered. Rogers left the movie lot one afternoon and went to see his old fellow rider. It was after midnight before he returned. Charles Dillingham, manager, producer, gave a comprehensive picture of the hard-working Will and his picturesque generosity. Dillingham said, "He was just like all other critics. He could tear other people to pieces, but let anyone criticize him, and he was grief-stricken. His industry entitled him to the place of critic. He was the hardest-working person I knew. During the long run of Three Cheers, he had a suite in the Hotel Astor just below mine, but I never saw him around, nor did anyone else. This puzzled me. Where could he be? I asked myself time and again. Then one day by chance, I found that he was in the theater at 9 a.m. He worked constantly until noon, then stole across the way and had a bite of lunch, then came back and worked again until dinner time. And even then, not content, he would often be back at work long before the evening performance began and long before anyone else in the theater was around. You see, he had discovered that the theater was the best place for him to work. There was no telephone there and no chance of meeting scores of people who are continually molesting celebrities, seeking interviews, introductions, miscellaneous favors. He had his typewriter next his makeup box and such books and papers as he needed, and his great energy kept him working continuously and happily at the many tasks he has assigned for himself. This studious isolation did not, however, crowd out his human side. He always found time for charity. Will Rogers' dislike of making charities public was honest and thorough. Sometimes he would be on stage at the stage door in earnest conversation with people from back home. To be sure, he never knew them out there and never knew of their existence until they appeared suddenly before him, urgent and needy. This did not prevent him from gruffly handing them money for their night's lodging and tell them to be sure to go to a good hotel. He had a habit also of going to the box office and getting $10 and $20 bills changed to $1 bills. Then, equipped with a wad of these, he strolled down the street. Curious about his intentions, I followed him one day and learned what he did with the money. It all went, dollar by dollar, to friends of former days, old-timers with whom he had played on the small vaudeville circuits when he was a beginner, poor also and unknown. "Will, give me a nickel for a cup of coffee," someone would say. Rogers would stuff a bill into the petitioning hand, then another dollar into another hand, and then he would make his way homeward. Cantor buys stock for Rogers. Eddie Cantor once had an experience with Rogers' generosity, although for a time, Eddie had some misgivings about the whole affair. Cantor had what he considered a very good tip on a certain trust company stock. He met Rogers and advised the Oklahoman to invest some money in it right away. Rogers, who believed only in investing his money in real estate and insurance, told Cantor, "I don't know anything about the stock market, Eddie." "You don't have to know anything about it, Bill," Cantor replied. "It's bound to go up. I am sure of it. I'll buy a block of it for you, and then we can fix up the money later." "If you say it's all right, Eddie, go ahead." Cantor bought the stock in Rogers' name, and Will went on the road on his lecture tour. The stock climbed steadily until it was nearly 20 points above the purchase price. Then came a slight reaction in the market, and the stock dropped off 2 points. Cantor received a long-distance telephone call from Detroit. It was Rogers, insisting that Cantor sell the stock at once. Cantor tried to argue with Rogers to hold on to it a while longer, but it was of no use. Eddie was angry because Rogers had not put up any money, but he sold the stock, and a check for $6,200, the profit on transaction, was sent to Will. In the return mail from Detroit was a letter from Rogers. In it was a check endorsed by Rogers and made payable to Cantor's Fresh Air Camp for Boys. Salvation Army, a pet charity. Another boys' camp in which Rogers had more than a passing interest was the Shag Bark Camp of the Salvation Army in Kennesaw County, Wisconsin. The Army was one of Will's pet charities, and in 1933 he gave $10,000 to build the camp. He also provided funds to send 225 music students and 150 Boy Scouts to the camp in 1935. When working on a picture, Rogers always would find out in advance the number of days allotted for its completion. If, as often happened, the production was finished ahead of schedule, he'd get a copy of the payroll from the assistant director and pay the wages of everyone in the company, with the exception of featured players, the director, and the others on high salary for the full time. "Sometimes it's a long time between pictures for these folks," he would explain, "and they need all they can get. I'd hate to think by speeding up a bit, I'd cheat anybody out of their groceries." When a friend once spoke disparagingly of the community chest and said that most of those receiving help didn't deserve it, Will made a characteristic remark which summed up his whole theory of giving. "What of it?" he demanded. "They're human, aren't they? And ain't they got to eat just the same as you and me?" It was not in money alone that Rogers revealed his charity. A story is told of the time when he was the featured star in the Ziegfeld Follies in 1924 at the New Amsterdam Theater, New York. Will was living out on Long Island and used the train to the Pennsylvania station every night in time to reach the theater for the show. One night, as he was hurrying from the train, he noticed a young mother overburdened with children and baggage. Rogers noticed the young, poorly dressed woman with an infant asleep in her arms, a sleepy child of about 3 years old beside her, and several large parcels. He stopped while the rest of the passengers left the train. Then he took the older child by the hand, gathered up the bundles under his free arm, and led the woman up the stairs to the waiting room. There he found her a seat, deposited her parcels, tipped his hat, and smiled. That duty performed, Rogers rushed away so they would not be late at the theater. Will thought no one saw that kindly act, but a neighbor who witnessed the incident told of it after Rogers had passed into the great beyond. Donated services to benefits. Rogers could not resist any appeal for aid. While he was starring on Broadway, he was continually being led from one benefit performance to another. He always donated his services, and the benefit performers showed him no mercy. Make that the benefit promoters. When he wasn't on the stage, he was speeding from one place to another in a taxi cab. Sometimes he didn't know what the benefit was all about. "Along about the seventh appearance before a different audience one night, I became kinder curious," Rogers said. "I tried to find out, and as near as I could gather, it was for the benefit of the poor golf players of Great Neck." Will at the time was living in Great Neck, Long Island, but he never took up the ancient Scottish game. During Christmas week in 1922, he appeared at a number of charity affairs, and one night it was in the early hours before he was finished. "I think I'll knock off and call it a day," he declared. It was only about 7 hours later, however, that he was performing on top of a bus in the Fifth Avenue parade of the Friars Flying Circus, raising Christmas funds for destitute children. "I didn't get no time to buy a Christmas present for the wife," he lamented, "but I sent her a few dollars to buy some food for our own kids." In front rank as humorist. In a sense, it was Rogers' charity work that placed him in the front rank as a humorist. During the World War in 1917, Winfield Sheehan, later to be his boss in the talking pictures, was named captain of the stage screen fund team for the Red Cross. The theatrical team raised over $2 million along Broadway, and Rogers played a prominent part in getting the money. Will, at the time, was drawing $750 a week for playing in the Follies and $250 a week for the Midnight Frolic. Rogers strolled into the Red Cross headquarters and donated $1,000 in cash. He then signed a pledge to donate one-tenth of his salary for the duration of the war. Then he casually, as he strolled in, he turned around and walked out. Sheehan, however, heard of it and sought Rogers out as a member of his team. He took Rogers to a luncheon meeting in the New York Chamber of Commerce where the teams reported daily. Rogers made the report for the stage screen workers and then at the same time delivered a speech that convulsed his audience with laughter. After the dinners had roared at his witticism, he suddenly turned curious and brought tears to their eyes. As he talked, he rubbed his own eyes with his coat sleeve. Some of New York's wealthiest men were in that audience, and the contributions that day made a record for the drive. From then on, the star of the Red Cross campaign was Rogers. Word of his humor spread among the workers, and they thronged to luncheon meetings to hear him. As a result, those who had never seen him in theater went there, and his fame spread quickly, not only in New York, but all over the country. As the years went by, he could always be depended upon to go campaigning for the Red Cross, and he raised substantial sums for the organization. After he became prosperous, he always started his work with his own donation, which was never less than $10,000. He was elected a life member of the Red Cross in 1927 after his great campaign in raising funds for the victims of the Mississippi River flood. The lengthy honor roll of Rogers' work for the Red Cross was as follows. McAlester, Oklahoma, mine explosion, 1919, 61 men killed. Made large personal donation and raised generous fund for families of victims. September 1926, worked with Charles Evans Hughes, later Chief Justice, in a Florida hurricane benefit aboard the Leviathan, raising $40,000 in a single performance. Mississippi flood, 1927. By benefit personal appearances, raised more than $100,000 for flood sufferers. January 1931, helped Red Cross organize nationwide drought relief broadcast, including President Hoover, former President Coolidge, and Al Smith. Drought relief campaign of 1930-31, an airplane with Frank Hawks, speed flyer, toured Midwest and Far West, visiting several cities daily and making speeches, which greatly accelerated chapter giving. Nicaraguan earthquake, 1931, flew to Nicaragua, gave $5,000, and cheer there, came back and raised a large Nicaraguan fund. 1933-34, donated $20,000 for continuing Red Cross public health nursing in places where it was to be cut due to the Depression. The Red Cross sent Rogers a pictorial report of the good done with his money. May 1933, Rogers wired the Red Cross his intention of littering up the mics with a little Oklahoma grammar to make contribution to a couple of good causes, unemployment relief work of the Red Cross and Salvation Army. Rogers probably played more benefits for charity than any other star in the show business. During Christmas week, 1934, he appeared at a dozen functions in the interest of the needy in and around Hollywood and Los Angeles. In addition to appearing in person, he invariably gave the chairman a check for $100 or $200 before he left with admonition to keep it quiet. The Assistance League, an organization of women relatives of film company officials that cares for the needy in the movie industry, always counted on a check for $100 every time he lunched in their restaurant. It was one of his pet hobbies to take friends there who could afford it and then make them pay the check after first seeing that it was for a sizable amount. Always ready to lend a helping hand. Rogers was ever eager to extend a helping hand to anyone in other ways than by gifts of money. Joel McCrea, the movie star, told how Rogers aided him at one time when he was discouraged and about to abandon his career in the films. He met the genial Oklahoman on the movie lot one day, just when the outlook seemed blackest. "What's the matter, kid?" rang out Rogers. "You look like your last friend had busted into the bank, stole your life savings, and then eloped with your wife." McCrea told Rogers the whole story and how he about decided to give up. Rogers listened patiently. "Son," counseled Rogers, "what you need is to get some good dirt soil under your feet. Get yourself a piece of ground that you can call your own, a place where you can run away and hide and invite your soul to go along, some place where you can get your perspective back, plant something, grow something, raise something, get some animals and see how you like it." McCrea bought a 1,000-acre ranch in the San Fernando Valley, and Rogers advised him on the purchase of cattle, horses, and farming implements. Crops were planted, and McCrea found life was not so dreary as he thought. As his outlook changed, so did his luck. Success came his way as he was given better and better parts. Will Rogers left an estate that was variously estimated. The exact amount was not made public, but it was generally believed that it was overestimated in press reports. A large portion of his fortune was invested in real estate holdings in California and Oklahoma, in government bonds, and in life insurance. His annual income came from motion pictures, his writings, and his radio broadcast. Despite his open purse and ready hand, he was regarded by everyone with whom he had any dealings as shrewd, but fair and reasonable businessman. Ranked as one of the most successful of motion picture stars, he also was among the few persons that carried life insurance of $250,000 or more. The bulk of his estate was bequeathed to his wife. His California real estate was considered valuable, included his ranch in the Santa Monica Canyon, a home in Beverly Hills, several oceanfront properties, and scattered holdings. A contract with the Fox 20th Century Film Company provided that he was to receive $200,000 a picture. Although film companies usually carried insurance on their stars to provide against accident and death, none was carried on Rogers, the biggest box office attraction in the industry. That was due to Rogers' air activities, which made the insurance rate too high. Professional versus social services. One story frequently told of Rogers revealed his shrewd business sense, at the same time his willingness to make those pay who could easily afford it. A California multimillionaire sent Rogers a formal invitation to attend a dinner at his estate. Rogers sent a formal acceptance and attended the dinner, where he was called upon to make a speech. The next morning, Rogers sent the wealthy man a bill for $1,000 for professional services. A secretary of the host protested and said that Will had been asked in a purely social way. "Oh, no," replied Rogers. "When people invite me alone, it's professional. When it's social, they include Mrs. Rogers, and she wasn't invited." The bill was paid. Rogers endorsed the check and donated it to charity. There were countless anecdotes of Rogers dealing with checks he received and turned directly over to the Red Cross and Salvation Army. In April 1926, he appeared at a benefit of the United Jewish Campaign and matched the proceeds of the affair with his own check for $2,500. In Philadelphia, where he put on one of his first one-man shows, for the benefit of the Charlotte Cushman Club, he charged $1,000 for his services. On receiving the money, he promptly turned it over to charity. So it went, wherever he was, Miami, New Orleans, Dallas, Hollywood, and scores of other places. Mrs. Rogers, naturally, was proud of Will's extraordinary wit, but it was far more thrilling to her when he used that talent for the benefit of humanity. Shortly after their return from abroad in 1926, she revealed that she shared and encouraged him in going out of his way to perform some act of mercy. "I am proudest of Will's humor," she said, "when it is used to help others in a material way. For instance, on his trip back from Europe, Will with others raised more than $50,000 for sufferers in the Miami hurricane. It delighted me to think that his humor and comedy could work together as such a force for good." Then I was pleased by another act of thoughtfulness on his part. One day, while in Europe, he read about the return of Miss Clarabelle Barrett to the United States with a $2,000 debt hanging over her. Miss Barrett had tried to swim the English Channel. "It's a shame that young woman," Will said to me, "who made such a fine effort, should have financial worries added to her disappointment." The young woman had already sailed for her home, so he couldn't see her personally. He sent a wireless to Captain Hartley, on whose ship the girl had sailed, and said that he would give $500 to a fund. He suggested that Captain Hartley raise the other $1,500 on board. The captain did. Loss mourned by charitable organizations. No one knew how much money Rogers raised and gave to his two pet charities, the Red Cross and the Salvation Army, but the airplane tour made with Frank Hawks on behalf of the Red Cross for the drought sufferers brought in more than $275,000. Rogers paid all the expenses of the trip, and outside of the time he lost, he was $12,000 poorer at the end. What Rogers meant to the Red Cross was expressed by James Frieser, acting chairman of the national organization. "Literally thousands of Red Cross chapter people will personally miss Will Rogers," Frieser said, "not only for his numerous gifts in the furtherance of better health, but on account of his encouragement to them, as he often unexpectedly arrived at a point where need was greatest." The Salvation Army voiced similar regret through Colonel William Arnold, Chief Secretary, who said, "The tragic death of Will Rogers will be deeply lamented in Salvation Army circles. He was a long and practical friend of the organization. The proceeds of one of his radio broadcasts, amounting to $25,000, were handed over to General Evangeline Booth, who applied the gift to the promotion of summer camps for underprivileged boys and girls." Puerto Rico recalled how Rogers had given a benefit performance for the victims of a hurricane there, and years before had contributed generously to their milk fund. Former President Cosgrave of Ireland brought to light the little-known fact that Will Rogers had given a benefit there on one of his numerous trips to Europe. Cosgrave said, "He was a brave and intelligent man who kept strictly to a moral code in all his work. His charity was perhaps his outstanding feature. Years ago, when we had a very serious disaster at Brumgallagher, he came here specifically to give a performance in Dublin to help collect a considerable sum for the relief of sufferers and contributed £100 himself. He was beloved by all who met him in Ireland, and all were impressed with his great genius, humor, and genial treatment of every subject." Rogers' big heart. Wherever Rogers went, it was a signal for those in financial straits to rush forward with their hands extended for a donation. In New York, it would be former actors. In California, ex-movie players. And in the cow country, one-time cowboys. Will was once sitting on the porch of a fashionable hotel in a health resort in the Southwest when an unshaven, dirty, bow-legged old tramp came up to him. "Don't you remember me, Will?" the little man said. "I used to ride with you in Zach Mulhall's show." Rogers knew that if all the cowboys who claimed they had ridden with him in Wild West outfits were enumerated, that branch of the show business would have had a larger census than the rest of the industry combined. He looked over to the stranger and grinned. "Old-timer," Rogers drawled, "you don't look like you was a rider. You look like you've been rode." But the big heart of Rogers could not deny the man and pressed a bill into the stranger's dirty fist. As he summed it up, time and again, "I never hated anybody or anything."